Now we're recording. Okay, let's go. All right, satellites. I'm going to sort of mix the two up in this lecture because it turns out that satellite dishes, although they don't look like coat hanger antennas, I've got a colloquial term for wire antennas. They call them coat hangers or wires. There are two types of antenna, as you'll see in this lecture. But satellite dishes provide a very interesting model of an antenna for deriving properties. So we'll talk about satellites and satellite dishes at the same time. All right, so satellites were originally proposed in science fiction, believe it or not. Arthur C. Clarke, the well-known science fiction writer, proposed satellites back in 1945. A Space Odyssey was made about this silly idea. Anyway, 1951 up went Sputnik, the first satellite. In 1963, the first geosynchronous satellite was sent, SYNCOM 2. Now there are hundreds of them in what's called the geostationary or the Clark orbit. I've never heard the Clark orbit ever used before. Geostationary or geosynchronous. Satellite communications, obviously, you have a line of sight to many different places on the Earth that are not themselves line of sight due to the curvature of the Earth. Most communication satellites are geostationary. I'll explain what it means to be geostationary in a minute, and then I'll rapidly mention what other possibilities there are. The geostationary orbit is a circular orbit in the Earth's equatorial plane. It's 36,000 kilometres above the equator. So the orbital period is exactly the same as that of the Earth's rotation, and I'll show you why in a minute. So a geosynchronous satellite appears stationary from Earth. It's a question of choosing the orbit. If you choose a lower altitude, you've had this before. If you choose a lower orbit, then the satellite moves more quickly around the Earth with respect. It beats the Earth in its rotation, and the low orbit satellites take about 15 minutes across the horizon. Any further out would be slower. So a geosynchronous satellite appears stationary from Earth. That's what geosynchronous or geostationary means. Okay, so for the physicist, that's a hilarious thing to say. Too fast means it's going to... If you give it a little bit of a kick, for geosynchronous satellite's gone forever, you'll never get it back. And if you slow it down, it'll plummet into Earth. So how does that all work? Oh, there's a picture of somebody's idea of the view of the Earth from a geosynchronous satellite, just in case you wondered how high up 36,000 kilometres was. All right, so how do they stay up? It's just the force, a balance between the centripetal force and gravitational force. So we have the centripetal force on the left there and the gravitational force on the right, where omega is the angular rotation speed, radian speed if you like, r is the satellite orbital radius, and little m is the mass of the satellite, g is the constant of gravitation, and capital M-E is not the mass of the electron this time, but the mass of the Earth, which is 5.98 by 10 to the 24 kilograms, or about 10 to the 21 tons. Now, notice in that equation, Einstein's principle of equivalence holds. The mass, the inertial mass and the gravitational mass are the same, and so the little m cancels out. They're the same thing. Don't depend on the mass of the satellite. And if you rearrange that equation, you have this famous law that relates r cubed to t squared in astronomy called Kepler's law. This was discovered well before Newton proposed the laws of gravitation and acceleration. And so at 36,000 kilometres, you plug all the parameters in for that radius, the mass of the Earth, gravitation, constant of gravitation, and t comes out to one day. So that's why geosynchronous satellites are stationary with respect to the Earth as it rotates. So the satellite is in synchronisation with the Earth when it moves. All right, everyone all right with that bit of mechanics or physics or whatever? Yeah. Okay, now let's go to antennas. That seems like a strange place to leave satellites. I'll get back to them in a minute. Your actual only interest in this is how to calculate link budget. So I've actually, when repeating this lecture, I've chopped off all the end bits about which ones were doing TDMA and FDMA and what have you, even digital TV and all that stuff. So Right, antennas. Antennas are the omega, if you like, of radio frequency electronic impedance elements. An antenna is just a, I forgot to bring my antennas. I have to draw them now. But if you have an antenna is just a device which has a terminal, if you like. Let's suppose we have the following antenna. There's an earth plane, and a bit of wire just sticks out from the center conductor of coaxial cable. Okay? The coaxial cable, let's say it has a characteristic impedance of Z0. The antenna here is an element. It's a terminal. You're just connecting it there. So if you put a vector network analyzer on this system, you can measure the impedance Z of the antenna seen into that wire. And you can see that because it's a wire, I'll show you, there's a picture on the web actually that I'll call up in a minute when we get through this to show you how to think about antennas. But see, what you have there is a wire sticking up in the air. So the simplest, there are two things that you could relate that to. You could think of that, because it's a wire, it has all the defects of a normal wire, and so it has inductance. That's true, it has inductance. But the problem is that it's an open-circuited wire. In this particular case, this antenna is what you'd call a monopole, and you usually let that be earth, so this should be rotated upwards so you can stick it out of the ground. But it's also a capacitor in a way. You charge it up and it has these electric field lines then that point down onto the earth. So, not surprisingly, antennas look capacitive at low frequencies. When you go up higher and higher in frequencies, on the other hand, this thing will start to look more and more like a transmission line. That's what it really is. It's a splayed-out transmission line, okay? But just for now, we'll forget about the physical details of this and just think of it. It's got to have an impedance Z, right? Called the radiation impedance. It's a complex number. And astonishingly, it has real as well as imaginary parts. Transmission lines which are not terminated in resistors and are not lossy never have a real part to their impedance. But antennas do. And that, you may guess, is to do with the energy loss associated with radiation. Now, I must admit, I'll say it right here in advance, that I haven't found a simple, but I'm sure Nick's going to make me work on it, a simple physical explanation, no mathematics except for simple algebra, that demonstrates why there is even an R. Because you could do it if only you could prove that the pointing flux, the energy power flux density, was actually finite, and even that's impossible. In simple ways. There are complicated ways of doing it. It's one of those things like the Dirac equation that predicts the existence of the positron, right? It's obvious if you look at the mathematics, but how else are you going to predict the existence of the positron, right? Unless you're Arthur C. Clarke and you just imagine one. All right, so there you go. So you've got Z-ant. And if you look into the terminals of an antenna, just consider this a black box, right? Here's your antenna. You're looking in there. It's going to have a Thevenin equivalent as well. Is that shock anyone here? Just stick any old bit of wire up. Right, a wire like that has a linear Ohm's law and linear Maxwell's equation, so it's a linear system. If you start drawing power out of it, it must look like that. A Thevenin, of course, it'll also have a Norton equivalent because they're equal. And this here. If the antenna itself is not being driven, then there is going to be a voltage there, and that's the signal it receives. So it presents the signal it receives to you as a voltage in series with the radiation impedance. Okay? And similarly, if there is no voltage that you're receiving, let's say, or it's very tiny, then you can just say that, I can't rub it out, but then they're going to do it and put a big black mark over it. Yeah, but anyway. So we just replace it by a short circuit if it's not there. If that's the case, you can rock right up to it with a signal generator, and guess what you see? The radiation impedance. So the antenna presents a radiation output impedance to you as a receiver, which is exactly the same below you see when you connect a source to it. And just like, and these impedances are very complicated, right, reactively. They have lots of variability with respect to frequency, and they always have positive values of R, not like our oscillator. They're passive devices, don't have any energy sources. And so if you want to do the best, then you better put a matching network in here. And this matching network, sometimes, when you're lucky, can be a transmission line transformer which matches over a range of frequencies. That'll work for antennas that have resistive parts that are constant and reactive parts that are close to zero over a range of frequencies, such as a helical antenna. But in the case of dipoles, Yagis, satellite dishes are also broadband as well. They're like helical antennas. They have constant radiation resistance with zero reactance over a broad range of frequencies. But dipoles and Yagis, most of those things have wildly varying impedances, which only ever resistive with a zero reactance at one frequency, or actually it's a discrete set of harmonic frequencies. Okay? When that happens, you need one of those early matching networks we spoke about, which only work at one frequency. Okay? Well, you may as well, I should say, because you gain nothing from having a broadband network. All right, so there's the antenna and antenna impedance. Now, let me just have a look. How are we going here? Yeah, all right. This is my favourite bit. Righto, so what do you know so far about antennas? Well, you know that they have impedance and they act like Thevenin, they have Thevenin equivalents. That's all right. In fact, to calculate the impedance of the antenna, you need sophisticated mathematics, right? Method of moments. But the trouble is that even if you don't know how to calculate the antenna impedance and you can measure it, you can still match to it and make it look like 50 ohms. Okay? Providing it's not too small. And by that I mean providing the antenna is not too lossy. Lossy antenna is one in which the metal wires that make up the antenna themselves have resistances inside them that due to Ohm's law, sigma, right, conductivity, that are significant in their magnitude compared to the radiation resistance. And when that happens, you've got a bed duct of an antenna. Right? It's going to be hot and it's not going to radiate. However, you shouldn't... that's very common that antennas are like that. Most of the ones you buy in... super cheap, those ones you stick on your car, 400 megs, or the broadband ones. Some of them are deliberately loaded up so they're broadband. Resistance helps to make them broadband, but it also helps to make them lossy. Okay. All right, antenna gain. Right, well, this is a... I'm getting down to there already. Okay.
Well, you had it hard last year, didn't you?
Here we go. Right. I was saying that impedance you can't easily calculate. You can't do it with computers and maths and stuff. It's well and truly understood, right? If this were a course on mathematical electromagnetism, I'd have had four bullets full of equations by now deriving these things, right? But that's just for the impedance. It turns out, because you can measure impedance and you can match it out of the system, but most of the time for engineers, unless you're designing antennas, it's not an important thing to be able to crunch out all the time. You don't do it as your favourite pastime. What's more important is the V open circuit in the case of the Thevenin equivalent. You want to know, if you put an antenna up in the air and you've got an incident radiated power, how much power are you going to receive? How many volts do I get out of this thing? That's what you really want to know, because that's what you need to know for leak budgets. In all the leak budgets you guys are going to calculate, you're going to assume the antenna's matched. So you may not even know what the impedance of the antenna was. But anyway, so we're not going to forget about impedance, I'll get back to it in a minute, but we're going to have a look at how it is we can calculate the power received by an antenna. Now, this view graph already spoke about it. There's this area called the effective aperture. Now, you may remember back to an early lecture, if you are standing in an electromagnetic field, there's an electromagnetic power flux density blowing by at the speed of light. And some of you may remember that electromagnetic waves are linearly polarised. You can always make a horizontal polarisation out of a linear one. The simplest is the linear case. The electric field, say the electric field is pointing upward, the magnetic field is pointing
horizontally, and the wave, when the wave is propagating this way, so they form an orthonormal coordinate system, orthogonal coordinate system, and the direction of E cross B gives the flow of power, the direction in which the power is flowing, and the famous formula for the power flux density of an electromagnetic wave is S is 1 over 2 mu naught times the time average of E cross B. But E and B are in phase, you know, like propagating electromagnetic wave in a vacuum. So that gives you, that's mu naught there in Weber's per meter, electric field volts per meter, and Tesla's, and the units of this become watts per meter squared. It's a power flux density. It's like a heat flow if you've done heat. The trouble with heat is that it's been dissipated within the material in which it's flowing, okay? But with electromagnetic wave, if you've got no means, like you're a big lump of Teflon, and the wave will just scatter from you and propagate through you without causing you to get hot, even though there could be quite an intense beam, intense field of electromagnetic, quite a high power electromagnetic field. Well, that's what that SI is. All right? So there's a simple equation. There's an assumption in it. Right, SI is the incident power flux density, watts per meter squared, that's called pointing flux. AE is the antenna effective aperture, one of the antenna magic numbers. And it turns out it's the same for all antennas. Just about. There's a few providers in that. And this is how, this quantity allows you to leapfrog over, well, what looks to be basically a very complicated science, antennas. Okay? Antenna effective aperture. And P is the power in watts, because area is in metres squared, right? I didn't say it there, it's in metres squared. So you receive a power. This is how you do it. It couldn't be a simpler idea than that, if only we can make sense of antenna effective aperture. Okay? So the general picture about an antenna is that it might look like a wire, or it might look like a helix, or it might look like a satellite dish. If you stick it in the path of an oncoming electromagnetic wave, it acts like a big sheet that absorbs power by absorbing the incident electromagnetic wave on it with a certain area. Now, there is an assumption in that. We are restricting ourselves to the case where the antenna picks up its maximum power, because antennas are directional, and I haven't explained what that means yet. And there's a second assumption, and that is that the antenna's matched to its load. If the antenna's not matched to its load, then you can't really get power out of it. Suppose you have an open circuit there, you can't put power in that, okay? But that's also a slightly complicated thing, so I'll explain that. All right, so let's go back to square one. The first thing I have to do is, the first thing I said to you then was that you have to aim the antenna in the right direction. Well, what the heck does that mean? Some of you may know that antennas are directional. These helical and Yagi antennas, log periodic antennas, which are broadband directional antennas you use for low frequency television, are directional. Satellite dishes are the most directional of all antennas, just about, but mainly because they're so big in comparison to the wavelength of the wave that they try to pick up, as you'll see in a minute. But let's start by talking about a hypothetical source of electromagnetic energy called a point source. Now, the physicists among you will know that such a thing does not exist. You can't have a point source, but by a point source I mean isotropic. Okay, it's an isotropic radiator. I didn't even mention the word there. But anyway, imagine sound. If somebody's laying flat on the ground yelling up in the sky, then everybody around can hear uniformly. Right? Sound is a point source. Yeah, that's not quite true either. I can't think of another example, but is there any true point sources? An atomic bomb going off inside the Earth? Are the sound waves there isotropic? Probably not. If it's a uniform mass density Earth. But the whole point is, electromagnetic wave is being launched by an antenna, right? And we want the power flux density of that electromagnetic wave to be exactly the same in every direction. That's a point source. And the first thing I'm going to say about antennas is there's no such thing as a point source antenna. All antennas have directivity. Now, I explain this in laborious words on the website, if you read through. If you read through antennas and look at these lecture notes and listen to my recording, then you should understand what I'm getting on about. very special thing. Oh, gravitation is a point source. Okay? A very special thing about point sources is that the power flux density on any surface surrounding the point source, right, at equal distance from the point source, is given by the power radiated divided by 4 pi r squared, where 4 pi r squared is the area of a sphere enclosing the source. So in other words, the power drops inversely as the area. That's what a point source does. And even though there is no antenna that has that radiation pattern there of a nice point source, it turns out that it's a very useful idea nonetheless. Right, we want to define a quantity called gain. Okay, the gain of an antenna is defined with respect to the point source. The point source has unity gain. Okay, that's the first thing. Now, the next thing that you must do, I've just told you about antennas, is that they beam or they focus electromagnetic energy. They're like magnifying glasses in a way. You put power into them from a generator, and then the antenna focuses the electromagnetic beam when it radiates, okay? And so there are preferred directions in which the antenna radiates. So to give you an example of a wire antenna, let's suppose that this is a dipole antenna. So I have two of these sticks. This one here is about, it's got a quarter wavelength of about 1.5 meters, maybe 1.5 meters or something. And so that it's got a wavelength of 6 meters, so this would be one of a pair of dipole elements that are driven 180 degrees out of phase, and it would be resonant at whatever frequency has a wavelength of 6 meters. What would it be? What wave has a resonant? Here, we've got to excite it like this. Okay, here it is. This is our first antenna. You can easily make these antennas. This is supposed to be the feed system. This would be the output impedance of the generator, and your dipole looks like that, and it'll have a current distribution like this, where it goes to zero at the ends of the antenna. The program Zagui models these antennas, and uses the main variables of the length and the thickness of the antenna. What frequency is it? 6 meters? 50 megahertz, yes, 50 megahertz. So you have 50 megahertz resonant. Or if you have a monopole above an earth plane, you can read about those on the web notes, just one of these is necessary, that'll be resonant at 50 megahertz as well. These antennas predominantly propagate in the equatorial plane. They launch in the equatorial plane, and as you move closer and closer to the end fire direction, which is along the element, they radiate less and less. And they radiate no power whatsoever along the end fire direction. So if I have a dipole antenna and I aim it at you, not going to get you there, right? It's going to go out that way. In fact, it's uniform. As you could imagine, the power flux density of electromagnetic fields are uniform in the equatorial plane, that is around this angle here. And the electric field has the same polarization as the. Just to give you a picture of this, let me go to the web page. Who's actually been to the antennas website so far? I actually nicked something off the web. Oh. Yeah, I've got to go to here. Oh. Hope that Internet Explorer sort of sympathises with me a bit. So here's the website. Oh, there's a picture of a dipole in action, and I've put the source right at the centre of the dipole. There's the current elements there, and you can see the electric field lines in red. The magnetic field lines are here in red, so they're the magnetic field lines are actually pointing in circles in the equatorial plane. And now just to show you what a real one looks like, there's a monopole where the dipole's cut in half and fed underneath an earth plane so that the electric field lines terminate on the ground plane. And down here, I have a picture of what really happens when a dipole... Let this settle down. It's an animated GIF. The antenna it's a dipole or a monopole. Well, in this case, it's a dipole because the ground plane would be here, okay, on this x-axis. But if it's a dipole in the middle of free space, the dipole's pointing upwards. That's what the electric field lines look like. So you can see absolutely nothing is propagating up this way. It's all propagating in the equatorial plane, and it's uniformly distributed around in angle here.
And you can see this distance here, from there to there, is one wavelength. And the further you get away from the antenna in the equatorial plane, which is the plane in which the antenna is standing, the more it looks like it's radiating a uniform electric field, a plane wave, obviously just by simple geometry. All right? So you can see the dipole has finite gain. All right? Right, now antenna gain, here's the definition. Antenna gain is the ratio of the maximum power flux density, S, of the antenna to that for the isotropic radiator with the same overall radiated antenna power. So you get a signal generator, you turn it up to 100 watts, you measure the power in a certain point for an isotropic radiator, you measure the same power at the maximum for your antenna, take the ratio of the two and you have the antenna gain. That's all it is. Ratio of powers. Alright, now there's one way that antennas' radiation is quantified that I should mention, and that is the equivalent isotropic radiated power. If you want to get a license to radiate emission, an emission license, the amount of power that you can radiate is always specified in terms of EIRP, equivalent isotropic radiated power. The reason for this is that because antennas focus, they can use to burn people's eyes out, putting, you know, all diffraction limiting effects aside, you need to burn a person's eye out, you need at least far infrared, wouldn't you? You need something in the order of a millimeter to really get it down. But the same kind of jamming and vexatious activity can be achieved at 30 megahertz with a big enough antenna aimed straight at Black Mountain or somewhere. Well, to prevent you from doing that, the power you're allowed to transmit is restricted, is defined by the EIRP. The EIRP is the equivalent, it's actually power. It's the power you put at the terminals of your antenna so that the maximum power that your antenna radiates is given by that of the isotropic radiator. So if you want to focus your beam down for a given power, then you have to, then the EIRP says that you must reduce the power at the terminals of your antenna to the point where the peak power you radiate is equal to what the EIRP would give for an isotropic radiator. Got that? So let's suppose the EIRP is 100 watts. Well, that means you can't get a helical antenna and put 100 watts into it. Why? Because an helical antenna could easily have a gain of 20 dB. So you've now got the effective radiating capability of a 10 kilowatt source. Right? You can aim out of Black Mountain, you could start to pick things up, right? 10 kilowatts. It's serious. And that's only with a 100 watt generator, like they have on the roof of their cars in amateur radio. You're along the road, 150 megahertz, 100 watts on the roof, right? They do. Amateur radio, you've got the license, you can do it. What they say you can't do is get a helical antenna and aim it at Black Mountain as you're driving by and beam down the power and zap them out. So what is the implication of that? Well, if you've got an antenna with a gain of 20 dB, 100 watts EIRP means that you can only put 1 watt into its terminals because it has the radiating. So you might ask yourself, well, what's the good of having an antenna with high gain at all? And the answer is that the high gain applies for reception as it does for transmission, and so you can sensitively seek out transmitters and reject co-channel interference from other antennas that are not on the same beam by having a directional antenna. That's the advantage you have. It's not an advantage in transmission necessarily. Unless you have it is an advantage if your power amplifier is way below the EIRP limit, then you can increase the gain. Everyone sort of get that idea? We're now thinking in a world that's combining space and frequency and time and everything. All right. Now let me just see. There's a picture of a radiation pattern. Radiation patterns are usually expressed in dBi. The dBi is a decibel with respect to isotropic. So if an antenna has a gain of 20 dBi, that means that the maximum power that it transmits in a given power at its terminals, the maximum power flux density it transmits in a given direction, the maximum flux density, to that of an isotropic radiator is 20 dB.
Okay? So you put 100 watts into the antenna, you've got 100 on 4 pi r squared at some distance, right? That's for an isotropic radiator. But if you have an antenna that's capable of focusing, then you can increase the power flux density. The amount you increase it by is the gain in the antenna, expressed in dBi, usually with respect to isotropic. And here's a picture of that. This is a plot of the power. This could be, in this case, it is power, right, because of these units here. That's in watts per meter squared. And so you can see the beam there forming. That's how the power looks with respect to the dipole for an isotropic antenna. Okay. Right. I'm going to state the result. And it's probably getting toward the end of the lecture, so it's good that I do. Remember I said that when you stick an antenna up in the air, it acts like a big sheet of paper or something and absorbs radiation coming into it. A fictitious idea, the area. Well, there it is. Now that you know what the gain of an antenna is, you know what wavelength is, there's the effective aperture of an antenna. Isn't that an amazing result? It doesn't depend actually on anything about the antenna, as I said before, apart from its gain. And there are lots of ways that you can get high gain. You can get a high gain by having an antenna array of very low gain aerials. Or you can have a dish, or you can have a helical antenna, or a Yagi antenna. They all have high gain, G, lambda squared over 4 pi. Effective aperture only depends on the gain and the wavelength. An antenna absorbs half the power into a matched load and re-radiates the other half. Why is that? Imagine you set up an antenna and you match it into a load and you're receiving power. Right? The amount of power you receive, you pick out of the incoming field, is given by AE times the incident point in flux, provided your antenna is directed so that its highest gain for reception, which is the same as transmission, is actually pointing directly into the incoming flux. Okay, so if you aim your antenna at the incoming flux, the amount of power you pick up by the antenna is given by that simple formula. We've had the formula before, but AE times the flux gives you the power into the antenna. Right, a half of that will appear in your load. Where does the other half go?
Is it because the signals are coming down into your antenna just being radiated out?
Yes, absolutely. But there's a better, less scientific way of doing it than that. Go back to the Thevenin equivalent. Okay? What was the Thevenin equivalent? Well, first we have a load that's matched to our antenna, right? And we have our antenna. The incident, this is a dipole antenna, so we know its maximum radiation is along this direction. And in fact, its gain is 2.14 dBi. Even for a dipole, it's got more gain than an isotropic antenna. All antennas must have gain higher than the isotropic antenna because they all have directions where they don't want to radiate, so they've got to put the power somewhere else. And that power somewhere else is where we calculate the gain, so their gains are always bigger than 0 dBi. Okay? All right, so it's this. So here comes an electromagnetic flux density, S, right at the antenna. The power going into the antenna is AE times S. Okay? And what Nick says is that we get half our power here, and he reckons we radiate the other half of the power. Can anyone see why? It gets scattered. Antennas are scatterers as well as receivers. And the answer is, well, look at the Thevenin equivalent. Here's our matched load. Right, this open circuit voltage here is the generator that corresponds to S. And this is the antenna impedance. This guy obviously has to be ZA star. So it means that the antenna impedance itself shares the power. It has to share the power with us. But the antenna impedance is that funny, magical, ethereal thing that we saw when we looked into the terminals of the antenna. We could measure it, but we couldn't see where it was. It radiated away. Well, here it is, rearing its ugly head again, this time dissipating half of the power we get in. So when I do calculations for link budgets with satellites, I'll always take an effective aperture equal to half the area because of this factor of two loss here, and you'll see that creeping up in the calculations. All right. The other thing to notice is that sometimes these effective apertures are humongous. Like at 3 megahertz, remembering the inverse dependence on wavelength, we have 800 meters squared.
And that's astonishing, because it means that if you have a wire that's that long, and say you make it out of a superconductor, so because the antenna radiation resistance of 3 megahertz is like 0.1 of an ohm for an antenna this big, but you can always build a matching network. No worries. So what you do is you build a matching network for 0.1 of an ohm. This antenna collects electromagnetic waves at 3 megahertz over an 800 metre squared area, sitting there pulling them all in. Now, there are a couple of practical problems with that benefit. First of all, it does mean that electronics at low frequency doesn't have to be so sensitive, because the antennas are pretty darn good. But it also means that it assumes you're not in a room like this, you have to be way outside. If it's going to pull in 800 metres squared, no good being in a room, you have to be out in space or out in a football field, way out in the middle of nowhere. The second problem is, unfortunately, nature responds by producing noise equally badly. So that even though you can measure, you can pick in electromagnetic waves from a vast area, which means the electronics doesn't have to be so sensitive, and the antennas are very sensitive, making up for it, all of the radiators in outer space have the same idea. So they all emit much better on 3 megahertz. So the noise background, the ionospheric noise, the whole lot just goes with lowering frequency. So we've seen it all before. I've visited that in a previous lecture. That's the noise power as a function of frequency. So it ain't always good to go to low frequencies. There are other reasons for choosing low frequencies for communications, but often, if you've got a directional antenna, you can make up for that loss in effective aperture by increasing the gain. And, as you'll see, it's easiest to increase the gain for high frequencies because the antennas have to get big. And the antennas are always about the size of a wavelength. So if you want to make a big antenna array, it's better to go up in frequency and get the wavelength down and then compress the array. Okay? All right, I'll leave it at that for today. Next day, we're going to... I'm only halfway through this because I haven't got to a link budget yet. But next day, we're going in our second lecture on satellites and antennas, we've actually heard two of them, I'm going to show you where effective aperture comes from, why it is, and who can tell me, who can guess, why it is that effective aperture is the same for all antennas? Just one word. You've seen it already in impedances.